And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's 5 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 2nd of May, 2024, and we're live for another 9 to noon show. How are you all keeping out there across the Northwest or wherever you're listening to us from? It's great to have you on board and stick with us. As I say, we have loads of different stuff for you over the 3 hours. Of course, we're going to cover the big issues of the day, but there's plenty of features and bits and bobs of interest for you. So stay on board and stay in touch. WhatsApp and text us on 086 60 25 000. Your WhatsApp voice notes can go to that number as well. Or give us a call on 07491 25000. And if email is your preferred form of communication, and you can get in touch with us at comments@highlandradio.com. Right, let's look at a busy morning for newspapers. Every Thursday is starting with the Derry People Donegal News. And Monsignor Kevin Gillespie has said the crimes committed by a former priest of the Diocese of Raphoe have brought shame and caused terrible damage to the lives of his victims. Monsignor Gillespie, who is diocesan administrator for the Diocese of Raphoe, appealed to anyone who may have been abused or may know of any abuse to report it to the relevant authorities. His comments come after former priest Eamon Crossan, who was originally from Letterkenny, was before yesterday sitting of Letterkenny Circuit Court, where he was convicted for crimes against a minor. Crossan had previously been convicted of sexually abusing another boy in 2021. At yesterday's court hearing, a victim impact statement was read out by the man who was abused by the former priest when the victim was just a boy. Horrific details of the abuse, which lasted over 5 years, were outlined. On to the Tyrconnell Tribune this morning, and the campaign for the local and European elections has finally moved out of first gear this week, with Peter Casey again running for a seat in Europe. There are now 28 candidates confirmed for... Oh, who dropped out? Be interested to hear that. Okay, Caroline Fahey. Okay, I didn't know that. Right, there was 28 in the running as of going to press, but that has now been reduced to 27. It's a massive field for 5 seats. And if you actually were to go down the list, 1 to 27, my word, you'd be there all day. But anyway, still a big field, 27. But anyway, reading on. Obviously, after the Pass the Parcel tug of war between London and Dublin about the legal status of refugees in recent days, this was the perfect timing that Casey needed to enter the campaign. It has added momentum to what's really been a lacklustre battle, despite 28 candidates contesting for 5 seats in the constituency. 3 weeks ago, Casey told the Tribune that he was not ruling himself out of the EU campaign. I'll consider my options, but I'm not ruling myself out, he said then. Obviously things have moved on since then, and he's now in the field, and it's a cramped field, and it's going to be difficult, I think, for candidates, regardless of their political views, to sort of separate out from maybe 4 or 5 other candidates. I think you could have been could have had a certain approach in the last elections and stood out with certain views, but now with 27 candidates, it's going to be difficult to sort of find your space and to resonate with people. Outside of those who already perhaps have a high profile, maybe they're already at something of an advantage. On to the Derry News, and a second SDLP councillor has resigned in the aftermath of the party's decision to select Lillian Sinoa Barr as Derry and Strabane's new mayor. Councillor Shauna Cusack tendered her resignation yesterday amid a row over how the SDLP selected Councillor Sinoa Barr to become the first black mayor in the North's history. Councillor Cusack, along with the current Deputy Mayor Jason Barr, were in the running to gain the party's nomination for mayor. However, it emerged over the weekend that Councillor Barr was selected by the party's management committee instead of taking it to a vote amongst the party's 300 members. And unfortunately, Shauna Cusack, in her statement stating that she was resigning from the SDLP, also stated that she won't be speaking to the press at all. Which is kind of interesting. It'd be good to hear what she has to say, because I presume she feels and I'm not having a go at her, I don't know the lady, but I presume she feels that the process was undemocratic. But I think speaking to those that democratically elected you through the means of the press would be useful as well. But anyway, that is her decision, and one which we shall respect, of course. The Irish Times this morning Ministers are set to consider a further cut in payments. By the way, I'm not obsessed with migration, immigration and all that kind of stuff, by the way, but it's the front of all of the papers, so that's why it's referenced every morning. So apologies if you're tired listening about it. It's not a hobby horse of mine, but I have to reflect what's being reported, and this is seemingly the main story every day. Ministers are set to consider a further cut in payments to Ukrainian refugees, and we'll meet today to discuss the government's communication plan after a tented encampment for asylum seekers in Mount Street was removed yesterday. The first meeting of the reconstituted Cabinet Committee on Migration will be held this afternoon, with ministers due to discuss the government's communication strategy on immigration and receive updates on deportation so far this year. Officials have in recent weeks been further considering the level of financial support offered to Ukrainian refugees. Three government sources said the topic will most likely be broached in the next meeting of the Cabinet Committee, but that it was a live discussion within the coalition. The issue could create tensions within government, as Green Party sources have expressed reservations about any plan to further cut support to Ukrainian refugees. The Green Party is understood to be sceptical about further cuts to benefits given the increasing numbers of Ukrainians who are leaving Ireland to return home. So what's happening is that the amount of Ukrainians being supported in accommodation by the government has fallen quite drastically. There is a mixture of those now competing in the private rental sector, those moving to other countries, and some opting to return back to Ukraine. So the pressure on accommodation from Ukrainians is not once what it was. And there are lots of spaces where Ukrainians once were. But I don't see it covered in the paper today, but a comment I thought quite interesting from Roderick O'Gorman yesterday is that now the government is actively reaching out to accommodation providers that provided accommodation for Ukrainians now, and they want to put IPAS, international protection applicants, in that accommodation. So that is what the government is currently working on to relieve the pressure on immigration. Also interesting yesterday, and again I don't see it widely covered here, is Rishi Sunak in the Commons made it quite clear that Britain is not taking back immigrants. That if an immigrant or a person travels through Belfast down into the south, the government here is insisting there is an agreement in place and they're going to use that agreement. Rishi Sunak is very clear and adamant that there is no legal obligation for Britain to take those people back. And he's very, very clear on that. And I thought it quite interesting as well, another little dig at the Irish government. He said that the Irish government should not be putting checks on the border, you know, in terms of immigration checks. And it's kind of interesting because he flipped the language that was used by the Irish towards the British back on the Irish in saying that it is up to the Irish government to ensure that there's free movement of there's no hard border. Which I thought was really quite interesting. But he's quite clear they're not taking them back. In the Irish Independent this morning, rents for sitting tenants are now rising at three times the permitted level under rental cap rules. The state body that regulates the rental sector is to probe why this is happening, but it will be the end of the year before it completes its investigation. The suspicion is that landlords are breaching the rules that limit rent rises to no more than 2% a year. Rents for existing tenants rose by 6% in the last 4 months of last year, according to the latest index from the Residential Tenancies Board. Rents for new tenancies shot up by 93% in the last year, despite the fact most of the country is covered by state-mandated rental pressure zones. This is one of the highest percentage increases in rental costs in the last year. The bottom line is, at this point, if you were looking to go into the rental market, it would be as cheap to get a mortgage, but you probably couldn't get that mortgage, if you know what I mean. Like, it has got absolutely crazy rental prices now, and it's not an urban rural divide, it's right across the board. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and static speed cameras are being rolled out in some of the country's most notorious accident black spots. Garda Commissioner Drew Harris has pledged that the devices will be fully operational by the end of this year and hopes their success will lead to the implementation of 100 additional speed cameras. The 9 static cameras are scattered across the country. One of them is on the Donegal N14 east of Letterkenny. So that's, in other words, at some point as you depart Letterkenny, presumably I imagine it's heading in a northward direction once you get to the Manor roundabout, or perhaps it's not. And I don't know precisely what the gap is between the two, but anyway, effectively, you'll get coming out of Letterkenny, for an example, the camera will take a picture or note of your number plate, and then further down the road, how far we don't know, it'll take another note of your number plate, and it will determine how long it would take you to travel between those distances at the speed limit. And if you're under it, you're fined for speeding. So there's going to be 9 of them rolled out, one of them in County Donegal. These cameras will join the new average speed cameras for the N3, the N5 and the N2, which are expected to be operational towards the end of this year. Sorry, maybe they're not. Actually, these are static speed cameras. These aren't average speed cameras. My mistake, actually. Sorry, I misread that. I was reading about this yesterday. I presumed there was going to be average speed cameras on the N4. The N14, but it's not. It seems to be just one singular static camera. So my mistake. Sorry to be misleading. It doesn't look like on that list we are getting sort of average speed cameras. But we'll see more of them down the country, and the explanation stands for where they apply. But it's a static camera that's being erected on the N14 east of Letterkenny. The Irish Farmers Journal this morning, an avalanche of direct payments penalties could be imposed on farmers who exceed their phosphorus allowance for agricultural. The Agricultural Consultants Association has warned up to half of the country's farmers are potentially exposed to phosphorus-related penalties. ACA President Michael Ryan said that, and so much more in that paper today. This is further down the list, but I do the papers in order, not necessarily in order of an importance, because there was an awful tragedy, another awful tragedy on the A5, and the two victims of a crash on the A5 are pictured in the papers today. And the terrible, it's a sad story, but there's layers of sadness to it. One of the two young people killed on the A5 on Tuesday night was remembered yesterday as a bubbly, outgoing girl. Camille was a year 13 pupil at St. Kieran's College, Ballygawley. She died alongside 19-year-old boyfriend Jamie Moore from Omagh, County Tyrone. The single vehicle crash involving a blue BMW car happened on the A5 Dougherty Road outside of Omagh at around 9:50 p.m. Camille had attended a protest by her school the previous evening calling for the A5 to be upgraded. Principal Paul Lavery paid tribute to the 17-year-old who had stood alongside hundreds of pupils at the school calling for change. And we know, unfortunately, the terrible loss of life, much of it preventable on that terrible road, the A5. And just the day before, young Camille had been at a school protest calling for the upgrade works to be begun as quickly as possible. I think, you know, that we're coming to a period of time whereby, you know, for many people listening, that your young people will be coming, will be doing their leaving cert and finishing school, and there's a rite of passage there and what have you. Also many of them will decide to go away. It's a bit of a tradition for some, head abroad. But unfortunately, we know that sometimes this can end in very tragic circumstances. So there is a government safety campaign, and I think it's really worthwhile just to inform everyone of the potential dangers of going abroad after you're leaving cert results. It can be done, of course, and it can be done safely, and the vast majority will have a great time and come home safely. But too many don't, and that's really, I think, why this is such an important campaign. But the deaths of two Dublin classmates in Greece has inspired a government safety campaign targeting Leaving Cert holidays. Andrew O'Donnell and Max Wall, both 18 and from St. Michael's College, died hours apart in separate instances on the island of Ios. It is thought Andrew suffered a fall while taking a shortcut back to his accommodation. Max collapsed from a heart condition. Yesterday, the government launched a Travel Wise as part of their annual Be Summer Ready call. Tánaiste Micheál Martin said, I was very taken by the deaths last year and in previous years. I asked the Department of Foreign Affairs at a number of management meetings to focus on something very specific this year to alert young people to the risks. And it's something we'll talk about on this show at a later date as well. Sometimes when you're on holidays for the first time, you come across things that you're not used to. You know, we often hear of tragedies involving balconies and falls from cliffs and what have you. So it's just misadventure. And it's best that they have all of the knowledge heading out to best protect themselves. And finally, if you're a dog owner, not to alarm you, but just to alert you, dog owners have been warned about Alabama rot as cases of the flesh-eating disease continue to spike across Britain, with locations across the country at risk. Alabama rot is damages the blood vessels in a dog's skin and kidneys. It causes visible sores on the skin and can lead to severe organ dysfunction and ultimately kidney failure. The rare disease has led to the deaths of 318 dogs in Britain since 2012, with 10 dogs so far this year dying. A number of cases were recorded in Ireland in 2018 after a similar outbreak across the Irish Sea. Infections were reported in the north in 2020. So as I say, no reports of it yet here in Ireland. If you're a dog owner, maybe it's socialising with a dog that's come back from Britain, to keep your eye out there. And our first guest today is a very grateful and relieved Slean McGlynn, who's the editor of the Finn Valley Voice and also a writer as well. Good morning to you, Slean.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm getting better, yeah.
Have you
Things
the leg,
are starting to you've, improve.
You have the leg up, I hope.
I have the leg up and can't put any weight on it now for a few weeks.
And we're going to go back to as to why that happened, because you, like so many others, decided to take a walk. For you, it was Sunday week last. What was your experience and how did the story unfold, Celine?
Yeah, well, Bartley and myself were here in the house, and our daughter, Maeve, and her partner, Will, were here as well. And if you remember, that Sunday was maybe the nicest day that came this year. It was absolutely beautiful. And we often go to Slieve League. And I've been going to Slieve League since I was a child. My father used to take us there, you know, on Sunday drives. And just as a very special place for us. And Maeve and Will love hiking as well. And we thought, perfect day for Slieve League. So we headed off anyway. And we went up the Pilgrim's Path. Stunning views, beautiful, beautiful day, great altogether. And Bartley and I stopped about around the 500 metres up, and Will and Maeve went on and did the one man's pass. And I've no interest in the one man's pass. It's a bit scary for me, so we didn't even attempt that. So we did, and then we were actually on our way back down again when I just, on quite level terrain, my foot slipped on wet grass and I went down about 8-10 inches, and I knew at once that there was damage done. And Bartley and Maeve and Will got me lying down anyway and put coats and everything over me, and they sort of got up to action, called 999. And it was amazing to actually be there and, you know, to be aware of all the phone calls and how many people were involved in caring what happened to someone who had fallen on Slieve League. It's just an amazing service. And I mean, and not just rescue 118, who were like heroes to me when I saw them coming, but Donegal Mountain Rescue were also on their way up, and the Killybegs Coast Guard team, and there was an ambulance crew also there. And I was thinking, so many people on this beautiful Sunday are here doing this, you know, to help someone who has fallen. And when the team arrived, Rescue 118, never have I been so happy to see that helicopter come into view, because where we live in Drumboe, Bartley and I often watch Rescue 118 as it crosses over on missions. And Gavin Plale, who was part of the team that day, winch operator, we know Gavin, and I've often spoken to Gavin. Like, you know, I just love to see the inside of it, you know, and you know,
not
obviously maybe write about it. No, this is not what I intended.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as I said to him, well, I only saw the roof, so I still have to see it. But they allowed Maeve on the craft, and I asked Maeve to record it as well, because you know, that maybe I could write about it. But
And what happens in that situation, Celine? Can the helicopter land? Is there a place it can land close by, or do you get winched up? Or
well, they actually have to see if they can land or not. Where I was, fortunately, they were able to land, like, so that I can't remember how far it was, but it was only a few minutes from I was put on the stretcher until I was actually in the helicopter. Oh. You know, so they were able to land. Had they not been able to land, you know, they would have to winch you up on a stretcher, which is very dangerous, they were telling me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually have to do that as well. Dangerous for the person who has fallen and for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so they just do amazing work.
So how long the initial call would you say it was before you were actually in the helicopter?
I was on the ground for about an hour and a half, I think. Say, from I fell until I was in there. I went onto the aircraft at, Gavin told me, 6:58.
Mm.
At 6:58. And I was in then Letterkenny at 7:18. But and it happened around 5, you know, give or take.
Wow, so that was really, really quick when you think about it. And what was your emotions at that time, Celine? Because I've spoken to people before in these situations, and they are so grateful. But at the time, they're like, oh, my word, this is embarrassing, such a fuss. I slipped over. Were you able to sort of embrace it and let them do the work, or were you a wee bit embarrassed in this by the situation?
I might have been embarrassed if I had fell off a stool on my kitchen, but where I fell, and you could easily do what I did, you know, in your own kitchen.
I get you, of course.
But where I fell was so beautiful, you know, like the view that I had of the sea, and I was able to look at that for all that time, and I had Bartley and Maeve and Will obviously there, you know. Mm-hmm. Encouraging and making sure I was okay. And I mean, it did feel a bit, you know, like maybe it's shock or something, but I just felt very trembly inside.
Yeah.
Every so often. But you know, there was because I always believe you can't live your life backwards. I couldn't undo it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I couldn't unbreak my leg. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had to deal with what was in front.
Well, there's very experienced people in Letterkenny University Hospital that can effectively unbreak your leg, i.e. set it and cast it and what have you. And you were full of praise too for your experience once you were taken to the hospital.
Yeah, and I mean, and we know how under pressure they are. We know how difficult it is. And the emergency department was, they told me, relatively quiet that night. It still seemed hugely busy to me, and there were still people, you know, sitting very close together, you know, but you know, they were doing their best, you know, I was on, you know, on a little trolley till the morning when I finally got a bed then, but I was comfortable, I was okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and you knew you were somewhere safe.
Yeah, okay. And it's like, Greg, you know, there you have a theoretical idea of course, we're grateful for the Coast Guard helicopters. We're grateful to Rescue 118. But when you're actually in that situation, it feels completely different.
Mm.
You know, and they're so professional, and they know what they're doing, and they do all the right things. And, you know, and they're just very warm and friendly as well. You know, they really, really were. I could not thank them enough.
Okay.
Actually, thank you really isn't enough. You know, you just think it's not enough. You know, I was chatting to Maeve and Barclay and Wool, and you know, could we have done anything different? You know, could we have been safer? You know, could we? Because would we all be fairly experienced and that we would know what to do? And I was thinking, you know, like, wear something really bright as well so that you can be easily spotted.
Yeah.
Because I had on a navy jacket, which wasn't a great choice, you know, in hindsight. And but Bartley had on a Celtic top, and that was seen, you know. So so that, you know, once they're flying around, they need to be able to see you. Yeah. And the fact that it was a really good day, I mean, if it had been a bad day, it would have been a worse situation, and you could get very, very cold. And when I was in the operating theatre, one of the nurses says, she says, yeah, you think that's, because I was thinking, it's only a broken leg, like, you know, and it's not that serious. But she says, on a mountain, you could die with that.
Yeah. No, no, for sure, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, and I actually maybe didn't realise that either until she said it.
Mm, I get you. Well, listen, I'm glad that you, and listen, the reason why we were so keen to speak to you as well, Celine, was just to recognise the great work that the crew of the Rescue 118 and the other emergency responders, the Kittlebegs Coast Guard team, Donegal Mountain Rescue, many of them volunteers, some of them not, but all ready to come to...
They deserve so much support.
Okay.
They deserve whatever fundraising people can do. I mean, they are the heroes, really.
Okay. Well, listen, I hope you're back on your feet in the appropriate timescales, and we really appreciate you joining us and helping us tell the story. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Celine.
Thank
you so much, Celine. I appreciate it.
Have a great year.
Okay. Thank you. That's Celine McGlynn, editor of the Finn Valley Voice and also a writer as well, talking of her experience last Sunday week where she slipped and hurt her ankle, and is just so pleased of the so pleased and grateful and thankful to those who responded to it. Dr. Farah Maiden is a GP and an aesthetics consultant and joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Doctor. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me back.
And the documentation I have in front of us is about vampire facials. Is that the preferred or given name, or is that just sort of how it has come to be described?
Yeah, I think it's come to be described since Kim Kardashian started getting those treatments. Essentially, what is actually known as is PRP, plasma rich protein, PRP facials or injection.
What actually happens in this process? I've saw some images of it, and it seems quite scary. But that could just have been the images that were presented to me. So, but what happens in the process of a vampire facial?
So essentially, what happens is we take the person's blood, we take it like we would a normal blood test. It's collected into a vial and it's placed into a closed centrifuge where we spin the blood to separate the good proteins from the red blood cells. And then it is drawn back out using a sterile needle and syringe and either reapplied into the skin, either using microneedling or injected directly into the skin or scalp.
Okay, and does it cause any bleeding or pricking or marks in the first instance?
Generally, if it's injected directly into your skin, you will have tiny little blebs in your skin that will go down in about 15, 20 minutes. If you hit the small vessel, you could have a tiny bit of bruising. But essentially, it's not very gory at all. However, if it depends on the method you use with microneedling, it can seem quite bloody, but generally that's not the way it should look.
And what are the promised benefits of it?
So it's beneficial in lots of different ways. It can be injected into the scalp to promote hair growth. So the idea behind it is that when we centrifuge the blood, when we get out the good plasma from it, that's full of growth factors and all the good stuff that will kind of drive your the cellular renewal and help with hair stimulation or skin regeneration.
Now, we have seen in the past, say, for instance, with Botox, and we've talked about these things in the past as well, whereby, you know, there are people who are licensed to do it or they have a medical background, it's okay for them to do it. And then others that sort of do it as well, really. And we've warned of the risks of maybe going to someone with not the, the right background or the right qualifications or the right clearance to do it. Is it the same with vampire facials?
So this is a bit tricky because the vampire facials, essentially all you need is someone who has phlebotomy experience. So phlebotomy is where you get training to take blood. And then because it is not a prescription product, it does not have to be a doctor or a nurse to inject it into the skin. Saying that, you know, we as medics or clinicians are kind of really, it's our basic principles you're to maintain to reduce infection control, like essentially to do it in an aseptic, sterile way. Whereas
I guess
someone
you.
Without that background might not necessarily have that, you know, background or instinct to do it.
And this brings us on to recent media reports of at least three women who were infected with HIV during so-called vampire facial procedures. This was actually, as it turns out, at an unlicensed spa in New Mexico. I mean, it must be incredibly rare if the media coverage is sort of going to New Mexico to talk about it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's really not heard of in clinics to have that sort of outcome where someone is being infected by another person, purely because we'd never reuse syringes, we'd never reuse needles, we'd, you know, use a closed system to spin your blood. There's no way of, you know, getting confused between whose blood is whose, you know. It's extremely unfortunate that happened in New Mexico. I mean, it's a simple thing that can just change someone's lives. You know, it's awful. If, say, for example, I took blood from someone who is injected with who has HIV, and I reuse that needle, that's going to have blood particles of the infected patient in it. And then when I reintroduce that into the blood system of somebody who does not have HIV, that's how it happened. And that is just, it's just tragic.
Caller wants to know, is PRP treatment suitable for older people in, say, for instance, their 70s and 80s with thinning hair?
70s and 80s, yes. I mean, it is suitable. There's no real cutoff point. But essentially, if you're well and you're not on too many medications, you know, it's your own blood quality. So it depends on how much good protein you have in your system. It's not a no-no. It's something that we'd need to discuss and speak to the individual about.
Are most clients, I don't know, can PRP sort of reverse the signs of aging, for an example, or do most people employ this to sort of maintain their youthful looks, or their looks as youthful as they are at the time of the procedure?
Yeah, it's quite popular for use with hair regrowth. It's also very good for skin rejuvenation, especially around the eye area. The eye area is quite delicate and there's not a lot of treatments that can be effective around the eyes because of the thin skin and just, you know, we can't use a lot of heavy products around the eyes. So it's good for, you know, improving the skin texture, the skin tone, the skin quality of the skin as well.
All right, okay. Well, I think people can be assured certainly that it's safe. It's just up to them whether or not they're interested. If they want more information, you're with the Medical Skin Clinic and they have clients across the Northwest and people can find that information out and get in contact with you, I'm sure, if they wish to. But for now, Dr. Farah Maiden, thank you so much for your time and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
All right, bye. Take care. If you've had an experience of that, let us know. 08660 25,000. Some of your comments coming in, and by the way, please keep them coming in to us. Very important. Kilmacrenan Village needs a speed camera. The speeds going through the town are ridiculous. People cannot get out at the crossroads in the centre of the town, and it needs addressing. Are we going to wait until someone is killed before something is done about it? Surely, with an election around the corner, one of the candidates could actively do something about it. It is a dangerous cross junction, that. And it's particularly dangerous, too, because it is used for families to access shops and what have you, but also for younger ones to access school. And people come down the hill from Letterkenny flying, and people start accelerating too as they approach that junction heading towards Letterkenny. And we've seen also cars coming in from the Milford direction that have been involved in collisions there as well. What needs to be done there with static speed cameras would guarantee everyone going slow at a junction like that. You know, these speed vans pop up here and there and everywhere, but I think that would be, you could make a really strong argument for a crossroads like that to have a static speed camera that would ensure that everyone drives slowly. They don't seem to be the weapon of choice from Ungada Síochána HQ, it would seem. All right, thank you for that, though. I appreciate it. Vinny and Marty, they've got their podcast, of course, the V&M podcast. Chatting about fibs just towards the end of the programme yesterday. Apparently Martin doesn't let his children watch the Late Late Choice show because it's on late and past their bedtime. So, rather shrewdly, he puts on last year's Late Late and tells them it's this year's one. Brilliant. Okay, so they're all wanting toys that are year out of date. I like it. That came in off the back of some fibs we've been told as younger people. I was talking about how there has been a trend where parents, when the ice cream van music is on, it's out of ice cream. You know what I mean? Because they don't want the hassle and all that kind of stuff. And there's been other little fibs that people were told as children. Keep them coming to us as well. What did your parents say to you as fibs? Picking your nose and eating it would give you worms was one I heard too when I was younger. Have you any more like that? Let us know. 086 60 25,000. Right, we're going to try and figure out what's happening with the SDLP in Derry and Strabane with Pat McCart after these. Right, Pat McCart's an author and former editor of the Derry Journal, amongst other publications and media outlets. Good morning to you, Pat. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good. We wanted to chat to you off the news that two councillors have now quit the SDLP after claiming they were denied the chance to be selected by party members to become Derry and Strabane mayor. Shauna Cusack, who has represented the Forsyth area since 2013, resigned her SDLP membership yesterday. It follows the resignation of from the SDLP of another councillor. We spoke to him, of course, that's Sperrin representative Jason Barr. Both councillors say they had been due to stand alongside side councillor Lillian Sinobar at an internal party selection convention on Monday night to name the SDLP's choice for mayor of Derry City and Strabane District Council, but there was an interview process apparently, and after that process the party decided to put only one name forward, and that was Councillor Lillian Barr. It's a mess for the SDLP, isn't it? This how this has been handled?
I think at the start they were going out. Here we are. We're making history. Very, very positive story. Lillian Sinoy Barr came as a refugee to Derry about 15 years ago. She set up the Northwest Migrant Forum. She's been very much the fore. She joined the SDLP, big supporter of Hume, what John Hume stood for and all the rest. And this, you can imagine how this is playing, that it's brilliant. And she was making history. She was the first black person to be a mayor anywhere in Northern Ireland. I think there's only two others, I think, in all of Ireland. And, she's been, Lillian is a very go-ahead person. By the way, I should declare a wee bit of an interest here. I was Lillian's sort of director of election when she first stood in for the SDLP back in, I think it's 2019, and so on. But anyway, the SDLP, I think they thought this was a positive story all the way around, but they do seem to have totally mishandled it, Greg. I mean, mishandled it big time. There was supposed to be a meeting. As far as I'm aware, there were some sort of, their management committee had sort of some sort of preliminary interviews with the three candidates. There was supposed to be a meeting on a Monday night where they were all going to set out their stall and to the 300 members who would then, they were, as far as I'm aware, they were allowed to canvass the 300 members. The headquarters in Belfast sent out email addresses for them so the people could do all they want to do, sort of why you should vote for me. Anyway, the management committee didn't put it to a vote. We're supposed to, candidates were told the meeting was postponed. It was cancelled, and the management committee came forward and said, "There's only going to be one candidate. Your names are not even going forward." It is a terrible slap in the
face. I'm not sure anyone comes out of this as a winner either, because if the process had been gone through and Lillian had been selected by party members, I just feel the way it's been done now, it's taken away from that historic achievement in inverted commas. And it does make it look like, and I'm not suggesting it's the case, it does make it look like that they saw an opportunity to make history, and maybe Lillian was selected for that reason and not necessarily because she was the best of the three candidates. Now, I'm not suggesting that for a second. I'm just saying that's how it looks, and it perhaps will tarnish. And then, of course, as well, because that's thrown into the mix, she has made quite controversial comments about people protesting, referencing at least some of them as terrorists. And that's brought those people out as well to pile on to Ms. Barr. So really, there's no winners in this, Pat, at all. It's been handled, once again, a political party has for some reason handled something terribly wrong.
Yeah, Greg, I've seen some of the comments on social media and I know what you're referencing. I saw one guy who, in fairness, a reasonable guy, said it seemed like a bit of virtue signalling by the SDLP that we're putting forward this sort of black mare, and they were so anxious to do it. And by the way, Lillian could well have come out top.
Exactly.
Anyway,
yeah,
the selection
that's
process.
Yeah.
So, so you're 100% right, Greg. It's handled very badly. But here's the thing. Seanan Cusack has been a representative for 11 years. Very, very highly thought of. Very well liked, et cetera, et cetera. Jason Barr, as far as I remember, is now currently the deputy mayor. And when you think about it, in your own hometown, you're sort of like it's a terrible humiliation, slap in the teeth, to be told you're not even considered for a discussion about to be the mayor, that you're actually just being overlooked. And you can understand why somebody who's been a public representative for 11 years would say, wait a minute, if I'm good enough to be a public representative, why am I not good enough to be mayor? And you sort of just go, Greg, who under God in the background made this sort of decision? The local democracy, it's just gone out the window. It's almost as if somebody was parachuted in over the heads of other people for a whole variety of reasons, but local democracy has sort of been just jettisoned at the same time.
And if this was a new policy that was now going to be introduced across all the districts, maybe then there's an argument to say that they wanted to go in a different direction. But this is not the case. This seemed to be a very specific way of doing something for this very specific job. And because they also had the interview process, it effectively looks like that Councillor Cusack and Councillor Jason Barr weren't up to the position of mayor. They weren't even good enough to go amongst the...
When you think on it, Greg, there's 300 members. And if democracy was really working, the members would make a decision. And the SDLP has always prided itself as being a party of democracy. So in other words, they're now saying the votes of the ordinary members don't count. The management committee makes the decision. But look at the other side of the story, Greg. I think, if I remember correctly, there's 40 members of Derry and Strabane District Council, 9 of whom are the SDLP. They've now lost 2. That's a big loss. Greg, I remember in my other life, when I was out in Derry Durham many years ago, as far as I remember, there was 29 members of Derry City Council, 15 of whom were SDLP. They had an overall majority. So right now, with only 9 members and a 40-seat council and losing 2, now I presume Seanan Cusack has made it very clear that the SDLP is their political home, and I presume they'll probably vote with the SDLP. But still, losing 2 councillors like this is not a good look. And the other thing as well, Greg, there's an election coming up next year where Colm Eastwood is the sitting MP. He's the SDLP leader and he's the foil MP. He won by 15,000 votes. If people start peeling away from the SDLP and because of things like this, and the Sinn Féin get their act together and get a very good candidate, I'd wonder how confident Colm will feel.
It was a mind-boggling decision, particularly at this time. And as I say, I have no doubt, as elected by the people, that the new mayor will be popular and has the support, of course, and the good wishes of Councillor Cusack and Councillor Jason Barr. But again, it's always going to be tarnished as if an appointment rather than an election. And it, as I say, it doesn't do anyone any favours. Interesting.
Yeah, it looks like the two councillors were not deemed worthy to serve. Now, let's get this on the record, Greg. And I'm just repeating what you said. Lillian Zina Barr is a very capable woman. She's very effective. She's a hard worker. She will. And by the way, I think both Councillor Barr and Cusack have both said this is not about Lillian. In fact, they said they urge people to support her. They have nothing but respect for her, and they've made this clear. But the procedure and the way it was handled, and absolutely, Greg, they have a real strong case. It does seem to be cack-handed the way this was done.
But it's all
it's
the
very offensive to the two people concerned.
The three councillors are actually completely... Not innocent, you know what I mean? This is all of the party's own doing. It's created this itself. Remarkable. As always, Pat, thank you so very, very much indeed. Lovely to talk to you. That is Pat McCart there, author, former editor of the Derry Journal. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Another busy 2 hours on the way. Stay right where you are as we take a break now for the news and obituary notices.